brought to you by Barfoot and Thompson.
On the show today, we are back with the fabulous Nicole Lewis, known as the Property Guru. Welcome to Property Matters. Welcome, kia ora. It's season 7 of Property Matters. I'm so delighted that this little idea back in COVID times has now reached its 7th season. A massive thanks to Barfoot and Thompson for their support of the show and to you, our listeners, tuning in live here on Planet FM or via our podcast downloads, which you can download from all your favourite podcast sites. We've had a bit of a long break and I was actually quite overwhelmed by the amount of people that wrote to check we were coming back. So grateful for your support. Sorry, the reason for the break, I went off directing the musical Jersey Boys out of Auckland. An amazing experience, but sadly clashed with our Monday shows. But we are back with season 7 taking us through to midway next year. Now, each week we're going to have a fabulous guest on the show, and I'll also kick off by chatting about something that caught my eye in the media over the last week in the property space. And in property news this week from Vanessa Williams, spokesperson for realestate.co.nz, school zones were very much in the spotlight. So Kiwis looking to buy a property in zone for some of the country's top state schools can expect to pay a premium of more than 89%, according to new data from realestate.co.nz. At the top of the list, no surprise, but Auckland's Epsom Girls Grammar School, where in-zone homes commanded an average asking price of $2.4 million compared to out-of-zone properties fetching an average asking price of 1.2. Auckland Grammar followed with in-zone homes fetching an average of $534,000 more than an out-of-zone listing. Vanessa Williams, spokesperson for realestate.co.nz, says properties in school zones have always been desirable, but this data shows the value buyers are placing on securing the right address. The data, based on more than 100,000 properties listed for sale between 1st of October 23 and 30th of September 2025, compared the average asking price of properties in and out of school zones, leading public secondary schools in Auckland, Hamilton, Wellington and Christchurch. The out-of-zone average for properties is within 5 kilometres of the school. Now, if we head down to Christchurch, and many of our fabulous listeners down in this space, properties in zone for Christchurch Girls High School averaged $1.181 million compared to only $647,000 for properties out of zone. That's a difference of 82%. Properties in zone for Christchurch Boys High School also averaged $1.18 million compared to $694,000 for those out of zone, a difference of 70.9%. Now, in the capital, Onslow College had the greatest difference in asking price between zone in-zone and out-of-zone properties. A home in zone for the college fetched an average asking price of $997,000, more than 20% higher than a home out-of-zone at $812,000. It's also giving us a little bit of an indication of where our home prices are sitting at the moment. But not all schools followed the trend. Wellington College and Newlands College both recorded slightly lower average asking prices for in-zone homes. And Williams says while school zones often drive higher property values, these results show it's not a one-size-fits-all story. Now, for buyers wanting to find a property within a desired school zone, jump on their website, realestate.co.nz. They've got a search by school zone feature, and you can find available listings that are guaranteed to be in that school zone. Now, if you spot something in the media you'd like us to unpack or talk about, or a guest you'd love to see on the show, email us, propertymatters@barfoot.co.nz. Now, I am delighted to welcome back for at least the third, possibly fourth time on the show, our fabulous friend of the show, Nicole Lewis, known, according to Stuff, as Property Guru. Welcome, Property Guru.
Thank you very much for having me back. Always a pleasure.
I have a young Nepalese friend that I'm helping out, a student here from literally a, sort of the shacks of Nepal that's moved here, and he always calls me Guru, and I always feel really old and uncomfortable, but he said it's a huge sign of respect. He said, my parents, a guru is somebody that helps, that grows, that encourages, that mentors, and that's exactly what you do, because your business, the property lifestyle, is exactly that, mentorship.
Exactly right. Yes, it is.
So, look, before we kick into sort of questions about property investment, actually, first of all, what was your take on the school zones? Did that surprise you, that volume?
No. Well, actually, yes and no, because, I mean, obviously we're buying properties all the time, so I have certainly noticed that firsthand with certain school zones where we look. But the high, those high numbers, you know, 80% more, 87%, that's
huge.
That does surprise me. That is pretty huge.
Yeah, you'd be pretty clever if you invested years ago in a property in a grammar zone.
Yeah, you have to know which school out of all of them is
where
going
are they heading?
To become the most desirable.
Yeah. So for anyone that hasn't tuned in before, just give us a quick background. Who is Nicole Lewis and why are you so passionate about property?
Yeah, really good question. I mean, I love property. So I think that where does it come from? I tend to think everybody deserves a home. And it used to be the Kiwi dream of you get up and you grow up and you buy your home and that's it. And these days it's become out of reach for a lot of people, like a lot of first home buyers. And I was really quite interested when I heard the statistics on this from certain mortgage brokers where they say at least 2 out of 3 of their first home buyers are helped into their property by mum and dad. And it sort of is quite real these days. It's really hard to get into your first property. You know, looking at KiwiSaver, I think the average first home buyer's age is 37. So it's much older than it used to be. And so I looked at it thinking, I think everybody deserves their family home, even if mum and dad can't help you. And there are ways to get there. So I've been in property I've been doing property as a full-time job for 20 years. I've certainly learnt a lot of tricks of the trade. So I like to share those with people. I like to help people. Family's number one to me. So if we can help our families thrive, we can make New Zealand a better place.
Nice. So it was about 6 months, I think, since we last caught up. So what's your thoughts been on the market this year?
Oh, it's very interesting. So I think my predictions were slightly wrong. only slightly. So I thought that 2025, the market would start lifting at a very small sort of pace. I thought we'd see some increases and then it would gather momentum in 26 and we'd peak somewhere or other around 27. But actually, and look, to a degree, the market has moved, but definitely it's split. And it's split across the country, like Auckland and Wellington are still pretty much at 0% growth since 2023. I think Otago's up 7%, so that's one of the leading parts of the country, followed, of course, by Canterbury, and Christchurch is doing very, very well. Then interest rates drop haven't made a huge difference. But nevertheless, things are, you know, the bottom of the market has been and gone. That's in our rear vision mirror now. So things are slowly, slowly, slowly picking up. In my book, the longer it takes, the better, because it gives us all opportunities to buy when the market's still ripe for the picking.
And when you say split, what's that difference between that high end and low end?
Yeah, well, split market, split in two different ways. Usually Auckland moves first and the rest of the country follows, and we're not seeing that at the moment. In fact, it's the other way around. The South Island seems to be moving first and the North Island is slowly following behind. If we look at the Auckland market, what I have noticed is that properties sort of around the 2.5, maybe even $2 million up is almost a dead market. I mean, properties are still selling, but maybe 1 in 20 of them are actually selling. The rest of them are just sort of sitting there. No one seems to be buying them. But the property market under that is moving along quite nicely. But then again, we've got, I think it's about a 10-year high of unsold stock. So buyers, still a buyer's market, no question. There's still plenty to choose from out there. But it's moving slowly.
Okay, and if you pull out your crystal ball for 2026, what's your gut feeling on where we're heading?
Yeah, this is interesting because 2026, of course, is an election year.
Ah, true.
And so traditionally, an election year slows the market down. And so one of my predictions is 100% bang on. From 6 months ago, I said, I bet come September, October, traditionally spring, people pop their houses on the market, are we going to see this glut of listings? And yes, we have, which is keeping it a buyer's market. So you'd expect that nothing much will happen over December, January. February, we get a whole lot more listings again. And then nothing typically happens over winter. But then with an election year, usually that slows everything down as well.
Mm.
Then on the plus side, we've got interest rates slowly, slowly, slowly coming down. I think that'll continue, but inflation is starting to edge ever so slightly up. So that might slow interest rates coming down. But then we still have a very high cost of living and we still have an uncertain business world globally. So businesses are seeing confidence return, but they're slow to employ people and replace people in positions, which, of course, has that flow-on effect. So I think the property market is still going to be climbing, but maybe only, well, economists said they thought 5-6% 2025, and it's turned out to be
2%.
Mm. Maybe we'll only see 2% again next year, especially with those elections in there. And it's an uncertain election outcome.
It is a little bit, yeah.
Now, to a degree, it won't affect first home buyers, but it certainly will affect just about everybody else.
Mm. Interesting. When is the best time to start investing? She's going to say yesterday to me.
No, so funny. I said this to my son. My son, Jake, is 21, right? I said, when's the best time to buy your first house? Because he's looking. He goes, I know that, Mum, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't do it 20 years ago, the answer is now.
Yeah.
So true.
Thank you, son. Well done.
Yeah, exactly. But it actually is a really, really good time to buy now because we've only just started to lift away from the bottom of the market. So the problem is when the market's going down and you're at the bottom, it's cool because prices are cheap, but it's really hard to borrow any money and interest rates are high. So at the moment, the banks are, they're lending, the LVR is being eased, interest rates are low, and so are prices. It's a really, really good time to jump into the market if you can.
So if you are buying an investment property, how do we do it to be cash flow positive?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. And I look at it saying in my property quadrants, we want a quadrant 4 property. We'll talk about that a little bit more. And you're basically searching the deal, not the property. So you need to throw out the window, you know, all of your emotions and your thoughts around an area or the type of property you love. Forget about that. You've got to buy something where the numbers do the talking. So you've got to buy something that's got more than one income. Like 3 incomes is good, a block of units rather than a home and income. It doesn't really matter where in the country you buy it. You've just got to make sure that when you pay your mortgage, your rates, your insurance, your property management fees and your maintenance, if you've got a dollar a week left over, that is brilliant. You know, buy it.
That's a good calculation.
Yeah.
Nice. And I notice you mentioned the professionals in there. As an investor, do you make sure that your properties are professionally managed? Is that something you recommend to people?
Look, to be honest, if you're buying something away from where you live, yes, a good property manager is worth their weight in gold because you're not going to be able to go down and see it. If you happen to buy something close by to where you live, then I'd say you always want to get a property manager to place your tenant.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no reason why you can't look after it yourself because it does make a difference to your bottom line. It is the biggest cost other than your mortgage. So it kind of depends if you can afford to get it or if you have to because it's nowhere near where you live. Absolutely.
And I guess it comes down to your skill set and your time. You know, if you want to remove that stress, then having a property manager just takes that edge off. When I caught up with you, I don't know if it was last time or the time before, I loved the story of you going on a flight, starting a deal at the beginning of a flight and ending the deal at the end of a flight. When you look back over your years of investing, what's been the standout surprise story, that one that you thought probably wouldn't happen, but oh my goodness, it did?
That, yeah, it's a really good question. And actually, you know, the key thing is perseverance. We often talk ourselves out of deals. Like we think, like that example of that one on the flight, you know, I was looking at that deal a month or so before and I nearly didn't go ahead with it because I thought, oh, I can't see how I can possibly make it happen. And I was actually writing the last chapter in my second book and I was quoting a story. And lo and behold, Ryan, whose story it is, was doing exactly a deal like that. He's like, I don't know how I could, you know, I nearly didn't bother because I didn't think it was doable. And he pulled it off and it was amazing. He, you know, made great money out of it. So I thought, no, carry on and do it. And I pulled it off as well. Doesn't mean to say you can pull off every deal, but keep being determined. Don't listen to any negativity. You know, don't let no come into it. And as I say to all of my mentoring clients, you follow every deal through to the end. Like, until the vendor says, no way, go away, or it's sold, you keep pursuing it.
And was the plane still one of your favourite stories?
I think so, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. Now, you talk about flipping properties, because it's something we hear a lot about with investors and things, but there's so many rules and regulations around that. Is this something that you do? And if so, how do you do it safely?
Yeah, good question. Look, I think flipping properties, which is what I call quadrant three, the active income. You know, when you are going to buy property, and inherently we run out of money. And, you know, property is a big ticket item, so it might be like, oh, we need $100,000. So flipping a property is a really good way to make something like that. Now, here's your keys. The flipping's all about the numbers. So you really need to be very careful with doing your numbers. You need to know what the property's going to sell for after it's done up.
Mm-hmm.
You need to know what your do-up costs are and your turnaround time. And then you need to buy it with some margin in it. And the best person to rely on to do the research is yourself. You know, real estate agents are one part of the puzzle, but at the end of the day, they get paid via commission. So they'll tell you what you want to hear. So you need to make sure you do those numbers yourself. Or, you know, a property coach or an experienced property investor you know can help you. And then you need to buy it well. And when you are doing a flip, it needs to be in the area you live in, because you need to be able to go and have a look at it and be hands-on and right. see what's going on.
Yep.
You need to keep an eye on your team when you haven't used them for the first time. So, you know, that's you do need to do something that close to where you live. As far as affordability is concerned, look, you can get asset lending for things like that. When I started out, I didn't even know what asset lending was.
So explain that to our listeners.
So asset lending is basically where you go to a lender and you say, hey, I've got a project. And they say, oh, great, here's 70% of the money. Right. So they don't need to see your financials. You don't go through a loan application and all of that stuff. They'll have a look at the project. They'll usually physically go out and have a look at the actual house. And they'll go, yep, we can see how your numbers are going to work. Here's the money. Okay, so it's more expensive than the bank.
Mm-hmm.
So usually they're about 8%. And you have a fee, 2% fee. But don't forget, you've only got the money for 3 months or four months. So it's neither here nor there.
So it's a non-bank lender.
It is a non-bank lender. Yeah, that is correct. But an asset lender as opposed to a long-term lender who's not a bank, if that makes sense.
Yep.
Yeah, so it's very easy money to get. You don't have to worry about, ooh, but I'm not earning anything, because that's what they'll have they'll look at your actual project. So you need to make sure your numbers are good. You still need the other 30% for your deposit and your do-up money, which you can either leverage off another house if you've got one, pay cash if you've managed to save it up, or use a money partner if you've got no money at all.
And are there certain rules and regulations, sort of law-wise, and about how quick you can flip and not flip?
No, not so much around that.
Because there was a lot of criticism, wasn't there, of, you know, these ones that sort of were flipping within weeks, because there wasn't a lot of renovation.
Well, there's two different things. Okay, so there's what I call a contemporaneous settlement, which is basically you buy a house and you on-sell it to someone else. You don't really do anything to it. So you can still call that flipping, but it's really just a back-to-back settlement. And then you've got the actual renovations, where you go in there, you renovate and you resell. There's nothing wrong with doing any of those. Either way, vendors get upset. They don't necessarily compare an apple with an apple. You know, like, once a property is renovated, of course it's worth more. And you've got to have the cash to renovate it. A contemporaneous settlement, yeah, look, I do a lot of those. So could the vendor have got more money? Potentially, if they found the buyers, which you often can't do, you know. So, you know, I've got no problem as long as everyone's being fair. And, like, if I'm going to buy a property, I do contemporaneous settlements. I did one not so long ago, actually. But my buyer still ended up with $300,000 equity. So even though I made some money off it as well, but it's a win-win-win.
I've got a lovely friend well into her retirement, and she's an amazing painter and restorer, and she will buy a house here, spend winter getting it up to standard, sell it in spring, or actually often it's the other way around, sorry, it's in summer, because she then uses that money, heads overseas to Europe for 3 or 4 months on what she's flipped, comes back and repeats the process. Yeah. Spends our winter over in Europe or somewhere on the money of the property, but she also gets so much enjoyment. Because that's the other thing, some people really love doing renos.
Correct.
You can make it a bit of a family thing to earn some money.
It's one of, I love it. It's one of my favourite things to do. I love renovating properties. Absolutely love it.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
So you mentioned at the beginning, you know, the first home buyer, and that, you know, it is, you said 37 is the average age, like, and so many people going to the bank of mum and dad to help with a deposit. Like, talk us through your advice for someone listening going, how do I get that first home?
Okay, here's what I'm teaching my son. So when, first of all, the bank of mum and dad is basically mum and dad doing it for you. So they're basically saying, here's the deposit, we'll gift it to you, and if you haven't got enough income, we'll go guarantor. So that's great for people that have got mum and dad who can afford that. But for everybody else, and here's what I said to my son. I said, okay, we've got to think outside the box when we buy your first home. So I said to him, forget about trying to buy quadrant one, your family home, go and buy yourself a rental. So if you search the whole of New Zealand for a rental, you know, you can buy properties for $300,000-$400,000. So whereas if you look in Auckland, they're $1 million.
Mm.
So first of all, you realise you can actually go and buy properties everywhere. And then people say to me, oh, but they won't go up in value. And I go, yes, they do. Every part of the country appreciates. So, you know, you go look at realestate.co.nz. Mm. They've got fantastic statistics on that. Every part of the country appreciates. So you'll naturally get capital gain. So forget that thought. Buy for cash flow. So I've said to my son, you go and buy something that's multiple incomes. So if you can find a block of 3 units or something like that, then you can be cash flow positive. Now, that helps with the bank. So my son's earning $60,000 a year on his first job. He's recently gone to the mortgage broker and said, if you can buy a block of units, he's looking at some in Gisborne at the moment, 2 units, bringing in, I think it's $1,170 a week in rent. So he can borrow $550,000 based on that. So it's like, right, now if you can pick those units up, big if, for around $650,000, that's only $100,000 you've got to put in. Now, he's managed to save about $60,000, so that's halfway there. So then, okay, well, how do we bridge the gap in the rest? Well, we've got two ways. One, mum and dad, we can give it to him, sure. But how does he make it himself? So here's what I said to him. I said, well, if you get 2 units and you buy them off someone contemporaneously, as long as they value up, you can actually have some deposit left in it by the vendor, you know, a bit of vendor finance in there. Some banks don't like that, but some banks do. Or you actually get them on separate titles and you sell one to pay the deposit down off the other one and you keep the other. So there's just a couple of different ways of looking at it, or rather than going to a bank. Now, the good thing about the bank is the interest rates are low. But if you went to a non-bank lender, like a project lender, they'll lend you on the valuation, not the purchase price. So if you manage to buy something, we did this deal. We did a deal like this, a property valued to $1.6 million, but we bought it for $1.2 million. So, and then we on-sold it contemporaneously for $1.275 million. So we made $75,000 from it. The person's got $300,000 in it. The non-bank lender will lend 70% based on the valuation, so you can almost buy it with putting no money in. Now, that's a big example because it's $1.6 million, but we've done other things that are cheaper. So it's a case of just sort of start thinking outside the square and start thinking, okay, if you can't afford your family home immediately, because it's the most expensive type of asset to buy because it's got an ongoing cost, you can afford a rental straight away because you've got rent coming in. So that example I gave my son, it's cash flow positive. After all costs, he's got money left over.
Mm.
And then we've got to just create a portion of deposit.
Brilliant. And I like what you're saying. you know, don't always think of your first home having to be the one you live in.
Correct.
In the city that you want to live in.
Exactly.
Yeah. Changing our mindset. How do you mitigate risk in property investing?
I'm actually quite cautious, to be honest.
Really? Says the person who buys on planes. Okay.
Yeah, I know. Well, you mitigate risk by the numbers. Mm-hmm. Like you've got to do the numbers. Now, I had a deal that I lost money on earlier this year. I haven't lost money in, I don't know, 20-odd years. And it was a high-end deal. Now, how did I manage to lose money? Because I've beat myself up about it for about 6 months. But at the end of the day, the high end of the market died, and I didn't foresee that.
Right.
So it's like, okay, I can't beat myself up about that. It is what it is. But then I looked at it going, how could I have mitigated that? So sometimes when you make a mistake or you have a loss, I look at it as an opportunity to learn. So I thought, right, what checks and balances can I put in place? And then I started a little group. We called it Propportunities. And then we thought, okay, can we do a bit of a deal den? We've got a little WhatsApp group. Mm-hmm. And now if we've got a deal like that, we take it to the group. And we say, can someone please play devil's advocate?
Right.
And so it's like, right, well, what if this goes wrong? Well, what if that goes wrong? You know, can we overcome those? If the answer is yes, 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 go ahead.
Right.
And I've just let a deal go now from that. I sort of thought, well, if the it's this deal that the market has to lift in order to make profit. And it should do, because in the next 2 years it should do. But do I want to go ahead with one that has to? No, I don't. So I walk away. Never be afraid to walk away from something. Take advice from people who are in property. Don't listen to anyone who's not in property, because what do they know? And do your numbers based on conservative figures. But then again, not too conservative, then you'll let a good deal go.
Should you ever invest in apartments?
I have done that. And I have discovered they're not as profitable.
Right.
Two reasons. One is, if you look at equity growth, what appreciates the most is land.
Right.
So apartments don't have that.
Yep.
The second thing is, of course, they have a body corporate, and as the apartment ages, the body corporate goes up. So you've always got that risk that there'll be a big expenditure at some stage that you've got no control over. And the other reason is that there's sort of becoming more of them now, so there's more competition. So you don't get as high a return. Mm. So if you're buying it as an investment, it's a single income. So it'll always be cash flow negative. So you don't really want anything that's cash flow negative.
Potential first home buyer scenario, because you can pick them up cheaper than a house?
If you love an
apartment. I guess the risk is the body corp.
Well, look, if you love an apartment and you want it as your first home's emotional. If that's what you love, buy it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's plenty of apartments around the place and everyone's buying them. You know, people live in them. So as an investment, I'd say no. And I can tell you from experience that the apartments I bought, hopeless over my house and land.
Yeah.
But if you want to live in one, and plenty of friends of mine do because you love it, buy it.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. All right. Now, you have released two books so far, Property Quadrants and No Money Deals. Is there a third book on the way?
There will be. There will be. And the third book will be about something around the billionaire mindset, you know, bankrupt billionaire, bankrupt two billionaire, the like, something with the bees, I don't know. Something about high-end deals and how to think differently and how to make millions of dollars with nothing, because I always like the challenge.
Nice.
But so far I don't have enough case studies. We've got a few good case studies, but I always need to go out there and do it for real first and then write about what I actually did.
So talk to us about Property Quadrants, your first book, and who is this aimed at?
So Property Quadrants, I basically had an idea after reading Rich Dad Poor Dad, Robert Kiyosaki, love him, and he talks about his cash flow quadrants, and I read that and I thought, oh, I think this relates to property. So 2 years later I came up with the Property Quadrants concept, and basically any property you buy fits into one of these four quadrants. And before you buy any property, you think, which quadrant am I in? Because there's a completely different set of criteria to apply to each purchase in each quadrant. So just quickly, quadrant one is your family home. That's your emotional purchase. You buy what you love, you live where you want to do. It's going to cost you money. Robert Kiyosaki says it's a liability. And I mean, New Zealanders, we have trouble getting our head around that because we go, but it's an asset that appreciates. It's like, yes, on paper it does, but in hard, cold cash, it's an expense. Mm. It costs you money every week. So, you know, that's quadrant one. It's emotional. We're driven. Sometimes we pay too much or we, you know, get talked into something because we desperately want it and it's triggered. So that's cool. There's nothing wrong with that. That's your family home. But if you're going to buy an investment property, you should be firmly in quadrant four, which is cash flow positive. You forget about what you love. Mm. Forget about the area you want. Forget about the colour of the house, whether it's on a main road or by a train station. Who cares? It's nothing to do with what you want. It's all about whether or not the numbers work. And it's like Jacob, my son, he's working with me at the moment. And I love listening to him on the phone. You know, he'll go put an offer in on this multi-million dollar block of units. And the agent, I hear him, the agent going, well, you know, did you make a mistake? And did you mean to say 900,000, not 800,000? He goes, no. We put it into our spreadsheet and that's the number it spits out. That's all we can pay. Otherwise, the numbers don't work.
Brilliant.
And it's like, you've got to just, you just... Yeah. Put it in there.
And stand by that.
You stand by it.
Take
you
the
don't
emotion
want,
out.
Correct. Mm. And you make offer after offer and you will get one. You know, that's quadrant four. Quadrant three, that's your active income quadrant. So, right, I need some money. So I want to go to Europe. I want to buy my next property. The government's put non-deductibility back and I'm stuck. How do I make $100,000? That is something you do with property. You know, a contemporaneous deal, a property flip, a subdivision, a joint venture with someone else. It doesn't matter whether you have time or money or both or neither. It's all about looking for how can a deal work for you and who can you partner with that can fill any gaps that you have. And then quadrant two, it's commonly the mistake quadrant where someone, where you buy an investment property and then all of a sudden you're broke, you're accidentally poor because it's cash flow negative and you're having to top up everything. And it is a cash flow negative property quadrant. It should come later in your property journey. It's like buying a holiday home or it's like buying an apartment or a unit by a university for your kids or an overseas property, like friends of ours bought a villa in Italy. That's sort of fine. That should come later in your journey where it can be paid for from the passive income from your quadrant four portfolio. So that's basically the four quadrants. And you can see why every property fits into one of those. And it's a completely different mindset right from the very start when you start looking at it.
But there's something in that book for everyone, every stage of their investment journey, whether first starting out and want to learn or actually have got a couple and want to go, okay, so what next and how do I do this safely?
Correct.
So then your second book, No Money Deals, that one shifts the dial a little bit.
It does, because that one's all about how to buy property when you're stuck for cash.
Yeah.
Because this happens to all of us. Whether you're buying property one or 101, you'll get stuck for cash. And so I always look at it going, well, actually, you know, you say to someone, how do you make money? The first thing that'll pop into the poor dad mindset is, well, I have to save from my job. And when I speak around the country to different property investors, I go, how long would it take you to save $100,000? Most people laugh. And I go, no, I'm serious. They're like, oh, years and years. But the smart investors, you can see them sitting back there nodding, going, oh, yeah, 3-4 months. Because they know property is a big ticket item.
Mm.
So you can mark a property up by anywhere between $20,000 and $100,000, depending on what you're looking for in quadrant three, and make some money relatively quickly. So it's a quadrant that most people go, oh, no, it's not for me. It's only because they don't understand it. Because why would you pass up the chance to make an extra 20 grand? You know, 20 grand is the basic level property finding for someone else. And people go, well, why would someone want to pay a property finder? Because they're busy.
Yeah.
It does take time.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got to sit and trawl through.
And know what you're looking for.
And,
yeah. And not wasting the investor's time.
Correct.
Yeah.
And you've got to know the numbers and you might have to put in 20 offers before you get one.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's something that people pay for all the time.
Brilliant. What's been your feedback from the book? Because that released this year, didn't it?
Yeah, look, feedback has been really phenomenal. It kind of blows me away. Like, people go, oh my gosh, I wish I read your book years ago. Or, oh, I've realised I've bought the wrong sorts of things. Or, hang on, wait a minute, how? Because I've got real examples in those books. And they're like, wait a minute, I need another copy of this Gantt chart. Or, oh, how did you actually do this again? Or, okay, now I've got to go and get three quotes for something, not just one.
Yeah, that's cool.
Or they'll say, oh, this example is in Auckland, but I'm in Christchurch. So it doesn't matter where you are. Go look out the window. Do you see a house?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay, well, it works in your area. So, you know, people, I really do love the feedback. People have been very, very impressed with what I've said. In fact, one of them, and someone likened me to Robert Kiyosaki. They said, oh, this is the Robert Kiyosaki of property. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. You know, someone else said, oh, I've read books and listened to books for years and no one ever tells you how to do anything, but your book lays out exactly how.
Hmm.
Yeah, because I'm like, what's the point of reading a book if you go, that's a good concept, but what do I do next?
How do I actually do it? Yeah, you want something practical.
Of course you
do. And linking all this back to your mentoring company, where we sort of first started this conversation, property lifestyle, how do you work in that space? How do you mentor someone through?
Yeah, so people, well, they usually just jump on my website. There's a link to book a call with me on Calendly, and people all sit on the sort of phone. They say to me, oh my gosh, I'm actually talking to you. Yes, it's me. It's not my team. You talk to me.
It's not AI, I'm here.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And we just have a little bit of a chat about where you are and where you want to be. And basically, like, I take on only a handful of clients each year because they work one-on-one with me and I guarantee results. I cannot see the point of having a mentor that's not going to guarantee you get a property. So we keep working together until you get something. And I've just had a win with a lovely young, I'm so excited, you know, a solo dad, and he didn't have a huge amount of money, and we just managed to buy him an amazing property, paid just under $700,000, and it brings in $1,370 a week. Just went unconditional on Friday, and I'm so over the moon for him. And you know, the first mortgage broker he went to said, oh, you can borrow $200,000. And the second mortgage broker I sent him to approved, and the property is done. So it goes to show as well, don't take no for an answer.
Don't be afraid to shop around and ask somebody else, because everyone's, I guess, got their own networks, their own ways of doing things.
That's right. And I love it. I love being able to help people like that. I'm so excited for them.
And, you know, Tarpery Hewitt, our resident mortgage broker on the show, you've said something similar to her today, that it's not always about the bank. There is those second-tier lenders. There is those non-bank institutions that sometimes are there for a very helpful, quick purpose.
Correct.
And you can always switch back to a bank if you need it later.
Sometimes it's easier to get a refinance approved than a new lending. That's true. And Tarpery's amazing. She's a brilliant advisor.
So where can people go to find out more about you, can buy your books, can contact you to talk about and do a real Zoom with you?
Yeah. So it is thepropertylifestyle.com. And you can just click on there and book a call with me. You can have a chat to me about anything. The book is propertyquadrants.com, or you can buy it on online or in bookstores or on Audible. If you like to listen to them, you can download the Audible version as well, which is read by me.
I was just going to ask that. Yeah, it's not AI.
No,
it's you.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, and definitely, look, that's a great foot in the door. It's a really good place to start. Grab the books, learn as much as you can. Always can ring me. You can jump online, chat to me.
There's a lot of Facebook groups for property investors and things. Is that sort of a good space for new people investors to go into, or do you kind of dive down the rabbit hole?
It's yes and no. So we do have a Facebook group, which is Passive Property Income with Property Quadrants. So, you know, that's a good one. And look, Property Investor Chat Group's been around for years and years, and there's something like 100,000 people in that now. The only thing with it is that what I have noticed is the bigger the groups, the more negativity that creeps in.
Yep.
And you want to be really careful with that. Don't let people who don't even know you put you off. So some online groups are fantastic. Your local property investor association, they're all over the country. They are a brilliant organisation to join. They have great speakers every month. I'm often one of them. But you learn a lot. The
and
people
it's got
are amazing.
That trust and integrity behind it. Yeah,
it does.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on once again. Time always flies when you and I catch up. We kind of blink and that's the interview over. But I really appreciate it. Do recommend you go and check out Nicole's books. They're absolutely worth a read. And we'll look forward to crystal balling in the new year and seeing how you went.
Yeah, see if I'm right or wrong. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Thanks to Barford and Thompson for supporting us. Have a fabulous week. We'll be away next Monday for the long weekend. Go and enjoy it, and I'll catch you the week after that. Have a great week. Take care.